Coming up on Weekend America.
Remember how tough it was to get your dream house during the housing boom?
They loved the place. We'd be writing the offer on the hood of the car. I'd be running it back to the office to get it accepted before anybody else could. And, you know, there's a certain stress level that goes along with that.
This hour, the upside of the housing downturn. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. This President's Day weekend, a quiz. What do vice presidents do all day?
So he spends his whole time in office suing the government and trying to get out of terrible debt. And drinking. Spends a lot of time drinking.
Putting the vice in VP. And what is the one word you don't want to hear from your driving instructor?
Because you go, uh-oh, step on the brakes and crashed. So guess who crashes? Came in the back straightaway. Who's crashed? If you crash, there's going to be smoke.
It's the Daytona 500. Weekend Americans, start your engines. But wait until after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to President's Day weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities. This weekend, the Daytona 500 turns 50. Later, we'll hear from a guy who looks like NASCAR dreamboat Jeff Gordon, but can he drive like him? We'll see if he can get on track. What are you doing this weekend?
Oh, this weekend, we're going to the ocean and La Brea tar pits.
Probably relaxing and doing a little painting.
I'll probably be watching political news on television, reading political news in four newspapers, and watching the days grow longer in the sunshine.
There's a party on Saturday that I'm going to, but other than that, I have no clue.
This weekend, I am taking my Writers Guild of America picket sign and setting it on fire because the strike's over and I do not need it anymore.
I wonder if he also burned his sign after the 1988 writers' strike.
Those voices came from Los Angeles and Ann Arbor, Michigan.
This is the radio show about what people are doing in America this weekend. Last week, we shared your stories of how the economic downturn has changed your weekends. So you told us about going out less, about playing Scrabble and cribbage at home, enjoying the free outdoors and other free stuff. We met a pastor trying to help parishioners who are hurting financially. We also heard from listeners who are doing fine in this slowdown. In fact, reporter Kurt Nickisch is one of many people raising his glass to the housing crash.
Not too long ago, I was a homeowner in South Dakota. Mortgage, taxes, and insurance for my house cost me just $450 a month total. So when I moved to Boston and was priced out of the market, it felt like I was going backwards in life. It was depressing. But now that housing prices are falling, I feel like I'm catching up. Home ownership is back in reach.
So was I smart to wait or dumber? Who knows?
You were really smart because this is the best time to buy.
That sales pitch is coming from realtor Diane Pienta. She's showing me around a condo in the neighborhood where I rent, Jamaica Plain. It's the kind of diverse urban neighborhood that was starting to give way to the pricey condo boom. This place is a beautiful old triple-decker.
This is a new conversion, so all three units are available.
Wide slatted wood floors, open floor plan, a big backyard with towering trees. Down the street, a Guatemalan restaurant sits right next to a Finnish cafe. This condo is just the sort of place that would have ignited bidding wars back in the go-go days, as Pienta calls it.
I mean, I could remember taking clients to an open house on Sunday. You know, they may have already lost three or four properties to multiple offer situations. They loved the place. We'd be writing the offer on the hood of the car. I'd be running it back to the office to get it accepted before anybody else could.
Now it's much more civilized, and so are the prices. Even so, this condo is still $350,000. Too much for me, but manageable for some couples.
We got married and have a dog, and it's time to get a house.
Alden and Caroline Codwell rent an apartment near the airport with their chocolate lab, Ollie. Alden's got a beard and works for a nonprofit. She's an interior designer, lends a little grace to his granola. Anyway, they're tired of signing away a check each month, not being able to paint the walls, or just having to listen to what comes through the walls from the neighbors.
We get woken up regularly at 5 o'clock in the morning with dishes flying across the apartment.
Lots of arguing.
Right, and it was always about who was going to be able to use the car.
It was clearly time to move, but Alden and Caroline felt trapped. It was the boom, and they couldn't afford anything here.
We threw things out like Burlington, Vermont, out west, maybe Colorado, I don't know, different places. Right. We were all over the map, basically.
Yeah. Your typical mid-20s couple.
But the boom turned to bust, and that was a blessing. So now they're looking in my neighborhood, Jamaica Plain. They started with lofts and condos, and they had some reverse sticker shock.
And when we saw the places and the prices things were going for, we realized we would probably be able to afford a small single family.
That was the dog shaking there just now. Maybe she's just as excited to have a house with a backyard. And I'm happy they're moving into the neighborhood. These are the people that keep Jamaica Plain unpretentious. Still, this isn't just about me and the kind of place I want to live. It's actually good for everyone here. And don't take my word for it. Alan Clayton Matthews is an economist at the University of Massachusetts. He says when housing prices fall, younger people are drawn to the city and stay. Innovative companies thrive on that talent.
The fact that the housing market has been soft here now is actually healthy for the economy.
So I realize that the housing slump has left some people with a sour taste in their mouth. But when the economy gives you lemons, well, I'm going to be on the back porch looking out at those big green trees and drinking the lemonade. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Weekend America.
Happy President's Day weekend, everybody. This hour, we're going to do something no one's ever done on President's Day. We're going to honor our vice presidents. And why not? They're never going to get a holiday of their own. So let's start with the 19th Vice President of the United States, William Wheeler. He's a man who epitomizes the phrase, "What you see is what you get." For more, here's Weekend America's Nate DeMayo.
If the name William Wheeler means nothing to you, you're in good company. Born in the sleepy town of Malone in upstate New York in 1819, Wheeler grew up to be something of a sleepy legislator. During a decade of service in Albany and another six in the House in Washington, he never introduced a single piece of legislation, and he barely ever spoke. So, it's 1876. The Republicans are having a hard time picking a presidential nominee. Supporters of Rutherford B. Hayes finally win the support of a powerful New York party boss. So to thank him, they tell the boss that he can pick the VP. As a joke, he says, "What about Wheeler?" Everybody cracks up and heads off to dinner. But the next morning, no other name had been mentioned, so Wheeler gets the nomination. When Hayes is told who his running mate is going to be, he responds, and this is a quote, "I'm ashamed to say, who was Wheeler?" Over the course of the campaign, Wheeler's wife dies, and he's a sad and broken man when he becomes the 19th vice president, where he glumly presides over the tedious deliberations of the Senate and doesn't say much.
That was Weekend America's Nate DeMayo. Now, don't go away. He's going to be bringing you more vice presidential trivia later this hour.
You're listening to Weekend America. This weekend, Philadelphians are marking the President's Day holiday at an exhibit, both historical and hirsute. The Academy of Natural Sciences is displaying the hair of several U.S. presidents in the first public display of these founding locks. The hair comes from the vast collection of an amateur scientist named Peter Brown, who collected thousands of samples in the 1840s and 50s. Reporter Joel Rose tells us now about Brown's curious quest.
Hair wasn't Peter Brown's job, but it was his obsession. Brown was a lawyer. In his spare time, he filled dozens of leather-bound books with samples from people all over the world, including the first dozen U.S. presidents.
Each page shows not only the lock of hair tied in a very delicate little blue ribbon, but also there's an engraved portrait of the president.
Robert Peck is a curator at the Academy of Natural Sciences. To be honest, the little snippets of presidential hair all look like the same mix of brown and gray, although Zachary Taylor's sample is curly and Jefferson's hair does look sort of red. Peck says it wasn't that hard for Brown to get his samples. All he had to do was ask.
He would write to the president or to the former presidents and ask straight out, "Can I have a lock of your hair?" With those who had already died, like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, he wrote to members of the family.
Turns out the Victorians had a thing for hair. They would carry it around in lockets, turn it into jewelry, even stick it onto postcards and valentines. Peck says Peter Brown studied fur from animals before moving on to humans in the 1850s. Besides the president's hair, he got locks from the heads of Napoleon Bonaparte, Jefferson Davis, and lots of other people you haven't heard of.
He has collections here from people who were criminals, who were insane. He tried to get the range of all of humanity, and he hoped that perhaps the hair would reveal something about the personalities or the inherent qualities of the people involved.
Which is not, it turns out.
Which is definitely not true. I mean, we know that the physical attributes really tell us nothing about the personality.
In that sense, Brown was clearly on the wrong track. But in other ways, he was ahead of his time.
Here, again, are two hairs from my head, and I have them side by side.
Lou Zoika works for the Philadelphia Police Department in its forensic science lab. He says you can tell some basic things from looking at hair under a microscope, color and shape, for instance, which might give you some clues about the owner. But Zoika says the real treasure trove of information is in the follicle.
That's where nuclear DNA would be found. And if we were going to do a comparison beyond the microscope, it would be with DNA testing. And we would need a nice root on the hair, a bulbous root with a lot of genetic material in order for the DNA people to be successful with their testing.
Which means there's probably not a whole lot of new information you could get from the presidential hair samples on display at the Academy of Natural Sciences. But curator Robert Peck says they still have their charms.
The Victorians found hair fascinating because it was the tangible either remains of a deceased loved one or the keepsake of someone who was far away from them. So there was something very evocative about a piece of hair. And I must say that still has that effect today. This is as close as we will ever get to seeing George Washington or Thomas Jefferson ourselves.
But only for a brief moment. Then the presidential locks go back into the archives, where they've been for almost 150 years. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Weekend America.
And I'm on our website right now looking at John Quincy Adams' hair. A surprisingly generous sample, considering the baldness of the accompanying photo. This might be sideburn hair, Des. I can't confirm that.
I noticed the same thing when I went to the website. That's funny.
The founding locks and so much more are at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
A man who looks like NASCAR hero Jeff Gordon finds himself going in circles. Coming up on Weekend America.
We'll be right back. From American Public Media, welcome to this three-day weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota. The Daytona 500 is tomorrow in Daytona Beach, Florida. The event started back in 1959, and it's known as the Super Bowl of NASCAR.
Except to NASCAR fans. I'm guessing that they think it's the other way around, and the Super Bowl is the Daytona 500 of football.
Well, you know, NASCAR fans are there halfway there. 98 million people watched the Super Bowl on TV this year, and about 50 million will be watching the Daytona 500 this weekend. Now, odds are on NASCAR golden boy Jeff Gordon to cross that finish line first. Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder has real mixed feelings about that.
You know the theory that everyone has a twin somewhere out there? Well, for the past few years, friends, relatives, strangers on the street have been telling me that I'm a dead ringer for
Jeff Gordon.
Oh, it would be Jeff Gordon, without a doubt. It's glaring, I think, just in every way. Facial features, stature, the way you carry
yourself.
When
I look at you, I think, is that Jeff Gordon?
That's right. The corn-fed, thick-eyebrowed Jeff Gordon, NASCAR star.
And he would be who? Who's he? Who is he?
That's my mom. Over Christmas, I sat her down for a little heart-to-heart. The whole, has anyone ever told you that you look like thing had really started to get on my nerves, and I wanted to get to the bottom of it. My mom went to college in Bristol, Virginia, home of the Bristol Speedway, so it only seemed logical.
And I was just wondering if there was any chance that maybe when you were in Bristol, Virginia, near the NASCAR track, that you had a baby.
There was nobody to date in Bristol, Virginia.
I'm an actor, and like me, Gordon shows up now and then in commercials. And also like me, he gets the occasional line or two in movies. I guess you could say we share more than just a physical resemblance. So the more people commented on our looks, the more I saw him showing up in my world, the more I started to wonder what it would be like to be him, at least for a day. So I signed up for a NASCAR racing class.
Main thing is the whole experience is going as fast as you have gone. You've never been able to do that on the streetcar. I mean, you could, but there's no cops out there chasing you or anything like that.
That's Eddie Bryan. He's an instructor with Drive Tech Racing Schools and the man who's going to teach me how to drive just like Gordon. Who does Eddie think I look like?
More like Jeff Gordon, maybe?
Naturally. Now, I should say that I once attended a NASCAR race and found it to be, well, kind of boring. Now, don't get me wrong, I loved the first bit when the green flag dropped and the cars raced around an inch apart at 185 miles an hour. The whole race to the finish and the checkered flag, I was jumping out of my seat. But the middle section, watching cars make left-hand turns for 3 hours, I mean, come on, Jeff. How hard can it be to do that? Actually, one of my classmates at the racing school, Zachary Bliss, thinks it is pretty hard. He sure can't do it in his Chevy Nova.
I've actually gone about 150 in my Nova before. It gets kind of scary right there on street tires because those things start coming up off the ground. It's like you're skating on ice.
That reminds me of this one time I went 45 in a 30. It was crazy. Oh, and what part of my visage does Zachary Bliss think most resembles Gordon?
I would say your jaw. Yeah, it does stand out. It's just like Jeff Gordon's.
Before I hit the track, I have to take a safety school to learn what green flags and white flags and red flags mean. Well, that is if I could stop fixating on Eddie's repeated use of the word crash.
Because you go, uh-oh, step on the brakes and crashed. Guess who crashes? Came in the back straightaway. Who's crashed? If you crash, there's going to be smoke. You know, one of them crashed. But we did have two cars crash yesterday. One was pretty bad.
Turns out Eddie uses the word so often that by the time I'm strapped inside car number 5, I'm a complete head case.
This is a really dumb idea. Okay. All right, just Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Okay, drivers.
But before I can get to the bit about praying for sinners at the hour of our death, Eddie breaks in.
Clutch is in. Switch is up. Drivers, start your engines.
Oh, boy.
Eddie watches us from the infield and guides us over the radio. Then, after a couple practice laps, he says those familiar words that, roughly translated, mean, you're now free to drive like a bat out of hell.
Green, 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 green flag, all cars, green flag.
The car, it's not my Honda Civic. For one thing, I can't see the front of it. For another, I sit so close to the steering wheel that my arms bow out. The seatbelt is strapping me in like I'm on a roller coaster, and maneuvering the car was like one day I woke up to find I had two right feet. I mean, sure, I can still walk, but I'm walking in circles.
So car number five.
After only one lap, Eddie singled me out on the radio.
On the exit of turn two, I'm going to have you wave your right hand, turn left and left for me, please.
That's to say, Eddie wants me to pull over because I'm driving like my grandmother. On the next lap...
Car number five.
Well, it happens again.
I'm going to have you wave your right hand, turn left and left for me out of turn number two. Car number five.
And it only gets worse. In no time at all, I've been passed four times, and I'm just like, WWJD, what would Jeff do? Then I remembered what Zachary Bliss, the guy who drives his Nova 150 miles an hour, had to say about Gordon.
He has his own attitude out there. He's out there to win. He's out there to do his job, and which a lot of their attitudes are, and it doesn't rub people the right way all the time.
Okay, I get it. No more Mr. Nice Guy. I put the pedal to the metal. In the end, I didn't hit the car's top speed, 137 miles an hour, but I did go the fastest I've ever gone, about 120. It wasn't Jeff Gordon fast, but you know what? I'm not sure I'd want it to be. Turns out making left-hand turns is a lot harder than it looks.
Car number five, checkered flag number five. Good job out there, Charlie.
People might mistake me for Jeff Gordon. He might be a much better race car driver than me. His cameo in Herbie Fully Loaded may be better than any performance I've ever given. But I do take solace in knowing that I get to do something Gordon doesn't do. Broadcast my innermost feelings over the airwaves.
Now here are Kelly Ripa and Jeff Gordon.
So you're telling me when Regis plays hooky, Gordon takes over?
It's been a while. Last summer? I guess it's right after I became
baby,
a new dad.
Yes, the baby was born. How is she?
She's amazing. He's sleeping really good through the night. I did bring a few pictures,
And when he does, he broadcasts his innermost feelings over the airwaves. Unbelievable. What's next? Gordon gonna start contributing to Weekend America?
I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. In the first hour of Weekend America, our newest contributor, Jeff Gordon, talks about fatherhood, his memories, his thoughts, his...
All right, don't even joke about that, okay? For Weekend America, I'm Charlie Schroeder.
Check out Charlie driving like his NASCAR doppelganger. Zoom over to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MBA Program.
Coming up, is America ready for a gay president? Well, maybe we've already had one. An historical journey for a President's Day weekend just ahead on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper in the Twin Cities.
And I'm Bill Radke in the City of Angels, and it's time for your letters. 2 weeks ago, we brought you the candidate blind taste test. We had actors read the positions of the presidential candidates, their platforms, but we did not tell you whose platform they were reading. And a lot of you told us you found this exercise really helpful, including Arlene Gunn, who listens to us on WNNZ in Ludlow, Massachusetts.
I figured I already knew who I was going to support for the presidential campaign. Still, I listened to the speeches by the actors and tried to honestly pick the one that I most agreed with. It turns out that it was not who I thought it would be, and I will now be looking deeper into the issues of each candidate and trying to keep personality from influencing my decision. Thank you for opening my eyes to the fact that I, like so many people today, vote with our egos and not with our brain.
Well, last week we brought you a story about how the sputtering U.S. economy is affecting people's weekends. And that prompted James Ellsworth from Fort Wayne, Indiana, to tell us how his weekends have changed.
Although I'm barely breaking even with the cost of everything being high, my weekends are still pretty good. I'm a musician, and I have a number of fellow players who get together, and we play on the weekends. There's not much money to be made in the coffee shops and small taverns, but it gives us something constructive to do. And we get free coffee or free beer and sometimes free food.
Earlier this month, I did an essay on my struggle over whether to have a second child, and that stirred many of you to write in. One listener encouraged me not to have another kid because the second or third, he said, is usually the black sheep of the family.
I wondered about that. I have two kids. What have I done? So to investigate, I turned to Dr. Louis Nguyen. He's the author of Healing the Hurting Soul, a survival manual for the black sheep of every family. And I asked him where that term black sheep comes from anyway.
Well, it seems to have come into the English language around the time our Constitution was written, about 1785 to 1795. Obviously, it has a reference to sheep, and black sheep are undesirable, perhaps because their wool cannot be dyed.
So, Dr. Nguyen, within a family, what are the characteristics of a black sheep?
The black sheep is the young man or young woman who will not abide by the rules of the family, which, by the way, may not always be explicit. But the person, for example, who decides that they don't want to go to college when everybody in the family for two or three generations has gone to college.
Does it increase your chances of being a black sheep in the family if there's more than one child? Like, can an only child be a black sheep?
Yes, that's possible. And I would say emphatically that doubling the number of children in a family has nothing to do with whether one of them will become a black sheep. Has nothing to do with that. What determines whether or not a black sheep will come into the family is a process that we call family triangulation. There are three roles of importance. Each role occupies one point in the triangle. The first role is that of the rule enforcer. That is most often the firstborn of that generation. Role number two is the person who the family feels it's necessary to protect for some reason. It could be, quote, the crazy aunt in the attic kind of thing. It's someone who needs protection by the family. And in order to protect someone, someone else's feelings have to be sacrificed. The person whose feelings are sacrificed is the black sheep.
Is there any upside to being a black sheep?
I don't think so. It's an unfortunate situation. If the black sheep succeeds in going his or her own way, the family will recruit someone else in that generation, in the generation of the children, to function in that role, because the triangulation has become a habit, if you will, for generations.
Well, Dr. Nguyen, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
We love to get your letters and comments and suggestions. You can reach us when you're spending time at our website. Just go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This is the radio show about what's happening across the nation this weekend. Since this is President's Day weekend, and we hear a lot about those guys, we have also been bringing you stories about America's vice presidents. We have another one of those in just a moment. But for now, back to the presidents. Did you know that from ages 28 to 32, Abraham Lincoln shared a bed with another man? Now, that might surprise you, but it's actually not the most surprising thing we have to tell you, because, in fact, it was pretty common knowledge during Lincoln's life. He talked about it openly himself. So what's the really surprising part? For that, we turn to Weekend America's Chrissy Clark.
Before I get to the surprising part, a note about gaydar. You know, radar that detects, quote-unquote, gayness. Now, the word gaydar, of course, didn't exist back in Abraham Lincoln's time. But if it had, and if the facts of Lincoln's life had blipped across its screen, those facts would not have gone unnoticed. Fact one, explains historian Gene Baker, Lincoln's relationship with Joshua Speed, a shopkeeper from Springfield, Illinois. Lincoln was a young lawyer who'd just come into town.
Didn't have much money. Had all of his possessions in two saddlebags. He went to Joshua Speed's store. Now, Lincoln didn't know Speed.
But Speed knew of Lincoln. Abraham was gaining quite a reputation for his powerful speeches in the state legislature.
And so Lincoln arrives and doesn't have enough money to buy a mattress. And Speed immediately says, oh, why don't you share mine?
Lincoln and Speed bedded down together above the store in a room they shared with a few other bachelors. 4 years later, Lincoln had made more than enough money to buy a mattress, but he was still there. Lincoln eventually moved out and got married. Still, he and Speed stayed devoted friends. They wrote tender letters to each other.
Lincoln signing them, yours forever.
There's more. Lincoln's late-in-life marriage. He was 32. His awkwardness around women. The poem he wrote as a young man about two boys named Biley and Natty, who get married and have a baby.
The egg it is laid, but
Natty's afraid. The shell is so soft that it never will hatch.
And then there's David V. Derrickson, one of Lincoln's bodyguards once he became president.
Ate with Lincoln when Mary Lincoln was away, slept in the bed when she was away, and once, according to another officer, was discovered wearing Lincoln's nightshirt.
So, here's the surprise. Lincoln's male bedfellows, the nightshirts, the homoerotic poetry, none of it seemed to matter, at least back then. There was one woman who wrote about the whole bodyguard thing in her diary. She was the wife of a Washington bureaucrat.
There's a bucktail soldier here, devoted to the president, drives with him, and when Mrs. L is not home, sleeps with him. What stuff?
And in the gossip department, that was it. Now, imagine how America would react tomorrow if we heard that George Bush was sharing a bed with his bodyguard. His masculinity would be attacked. A fuse would blow in the country's collective gaydar. But in 1862, Baker says Lincoln's close relations with men inspired more of a collective yawn.
In his time, Lincoln was mocked for many, many things. But he was never, never mocked for this.
I think what Lincoln's experience really alerts us to.
George Chauncey teaches history at Yale University.
Is that he and the people who lived in his time lived in a really different emotional and erotic universe than we do today.
Of course, there's a huge controversy over how to interpret the details of Lincoln's personal life. Plenty of men shared beds in those days purely out of convenience.
I have to remember, it was a much less rich society than this, and so there were fewer beds to go around.
Right, you couldn't just buy one at IKEA when you needed
right.
it. And back then, there was nothing unmasculine about writing tender things to a male friend. So was Lincoln gay or wasn't he? No one knows. But that's not the most interesting question, says Chauncey. What interests Chauncey is this. When did Americans start caring about who was gay and who wasn't? When did who you sleep with start to define who you are?
The categories of heterosexuality and homosexuality just didn't exist for people in most of the 19th century and the way that they do for us today, when they stand as really powerful boundaries for all of us as we're trying to think about who we are sexually.
To be clear, America has always liked its men manly and its women feminine. Sodomy laws have been on the books since the beginning. But society's rules around what was proper masculine behavior took a dramatic shift in the early 1900s. To illustrate this point, Chauncey takes out some old pictures of the men's football and crew teams at Yale. First, he shows photographs from the 1880s.
They've got their arms all over each other. They're leaning into each other. Sometimes they have their hands not just on each other's shoulders, but on their knees.
And then, around the 1920s, the poses start to change.
And suddenly they're putting their hands clasped before them or on their hips or clasped behind them anywhere but on the other men around them. And I think that sort of records a growing anxiety about physical as well as emotional intimacy between men.
So how, in just a few decades, did America go from a place where manly men could share beds to this?
One never knows when the homosexual is about.
Do you want your son enticed into the world of homosexuals?
When did figuring out who's gay and who's not become such a national obsession? It's hard to say exactly, but Chauncey has two possible ingredients: an increased awareness of sex, thanks to Freud, and Coney Island.
Dance halls, certain kinds of restaurants, Coney Island and so forth, where young men and women were encouraged to spend time together and develop partnerships in a way that wouldn't have been true in an earlier generation when people were expected to remain fairly sex segregated.
By the 1920s, men and women had more places to flirt, to hang out, to share the same social space. And there were more chances to scrutinize how we behaved around each other. For men, it wasn't enough to be just one of the guys anymore. Now you had to broadcast your manliness, and that was becoming all wrapped up in how attracted you were to women. Of course, even in Lincoln's day, there were some things that could get a man immediately suspected of being unmasculine, deviant. Again, historian Jean Baker.
If you didn't go to vote, by the way, which was the masculine endeavor of this time, you were called a Nancy girl.
Voting was, after all, something only men could do at the time.
And party politics was an entirely masculine affair built around parades and solidarity among men.
The word homosexuality didn't exist back in Lincoln's day. But more than that, the concept didn't exist. People didn't have sexual identities.
Today, if you ask someone who they are, you might get the answer, I'm gay, which would be the first identification. If you ask someone in the 19th century who they were, they would say, I am a Republican from the state of Illinois.
So even if Lincoln was gay in the way we think about it today, his contemporaries cared much more about his political identity than his sexual one. I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Speaking of presidents and their so-called partners, this holiday weekend, we're giving a nod to that silent partner in every White House. No, not the First Lady. Although many like Eleanor Roosevelt and Nancy Reagan played a strong role in leading the nation. No, today we're paying tribute to the vice presidents, like William Rufus King. Although, come to think of it, some say he had a lot in common with Miss Nancy. Here's Nate DeMeo to fill us in.
William Rufus Devane King was a man born to be vice president. But he was born in a time when that wasn't necessarily an insult. In the middle of the 19th century, the VP was expected to run the Senate, providing a steady hand, maintaining civility, and keeping the legislative process flowing. And in his years of service as a lawmaker and a diplomat, King earned a reputation as a modest and reasonable guy. He was well-liked, he was accommodating, not interested in glory or fame. A perfect vice president. And King really wanted the job. So in 1852, he gets on the ticket with Franklin Pierce. They're marching toward an easy victory. But meanwhile, King starts coughing a lot. By the time they win, King is coughing all the time. And anyone who's ever watched a film adaptation of a Jane Austen novel can guess what comes next. He heads down to Cuba, hoping a little tropical air will help out his consumption. It doesn't. Out of respect for King, knowing full well where this whole thing is going, Congress passes this one-time law that allows the vice president to be sworn in on foreign soil. In a somber ceremony, William King becomes the 13th vice president of the United States. A month later, he's dead, and John Breckinridge becomes the 14th. Now, here's your other interesting historical footnote on King. He and future President James Buchanan were roommates for 15 years. One of several facts that have prompted some historians to propose that the two men were America's first gay vice president and president, respectively. Here are some others. The press at the time wrote articles speculating about it. Both men's relatives suspiciously burned all of the correspondence between the two. The Postmaster General used to call the pair Buchanan and his wife. And Andrew Jackson called King Miss Nancy. Really. But we'll never know for sure. And at least one historian says that Andrew Jackson called a lot of people Miss Nancy.
Stay tuned for more about the lives of our vice presidents from Nate DeMayo. By Monday, daytime temperatures will decline to 19 in Lincoln, Nebraska, and to 16 in Madison, Wisconsin. But in Washington, D.C., it'll be in the mid-50s. For more weather, here's Week in America's John Moe.
You wouldn't want to be caught dead in West Fork, Arkansas. Oh, it's a nice place and has 46 degrees and light clouds, but don't be caught dead there because it's crawling with vultures. They host a vulture event with viewing sessions and other festivities. I hope they serve coffee. You would not want to doze off out on the grass. The eel pout is not a festive fish. Nonetheless, Walker, Minnesota holds an International Eel Pout Festival. International because some guys from Canada might show up. Besides fishing, there's ice drilling, ice auto race, and sled dog rides, all held under snow and 30 degrees. The eel pout call it the Minnesotans Doing Crazy Stuff and Trying to Kill Us Festival. It's not a very catchy name, but remember, they are fish. Mike Huckabee raised eyebrows when he detailed how to cook squirrel in a popcorn popper. And though I know nothing about politics in Dunbar, West Virginia, I'm pretty sure it's Huckabee country. 39 in clouds for the Dunbar Critter Dinner. Bear, gator, frogs, and, yep, squirrel are offered. Also drinks and salads, although the salads are made of raccoons. And so are the drinks. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
If you want to be happy this Lunar New Year, go see the fortune teller next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by LendingTree, helping customers find the fixed-rate loan that's right for them. You can choose from up to four offers today, 1-800-555-TREE or at LendingTree.com. When banks compete, you win.
We are now a week and a half into the Lunar New Year, the year of the rat, according to Chinese astrology. People born in a rat year are said to be smart, mischievous, and maybe a little too clever for their own good. Famous rats include Galileo, Shakespeare, Jimmy Carter, and Eminem.
And Dez! I'm a rat, too.
And Dez.
And like a lot of people, I like to take the new year to reflect on the past and look toward the future. For Week in America, Shirley Shin, it's a time to visit her neighborhood psychic.
I've always gone to fortune tellers. It started off at an early age. I followed my aunts who would visit fortune tellers before any big events or big decisions. My cousin wants to get married. Let's go see a fortune teller. My uncle wants to start a new business. Let's go see a fortune teller. Time to take the college boards. Let's go see a fortune teller. And that's me 1 year ago with a Korean shaman in Los Angeles. She took down my birthday, consulted some charts, and pronounced my fate for 2007. Number one, marry my boyfriend. Number two, my mom's health was in jeopardy. Number three, piles of money coming my way. So now it's 2008. I'm still broke, my mom's healthy, and I'm still not married. So this new year, a new tactic. Three different clairvoyants who are all sure to give me the same fortune, right?
Wow, you're right on time.
I didn't have to go far to get my first reading. Just a few blocks from my apartment, a tiny pink building, Mrs. Lin's psychic reading shop. It's about 10 by 12 and shares a parking lot with a 7-Eleven.
Okay, that seems to be all ready to go. Now we should be able to get some pictures. And let me know if you see anything, a picture of a house or a boot or whatever.
A tea leaf reading is a little like an inkblot test. You look for images in the patterns of the tea leaves that remain in the cup. I try to tap into my childhood imagination. I try to let the leaves speak to me. I stare hard.
I feel like you have a couple of whales in here.
I thought that was a helicopter.
No, not this one. This one. The whale is a symbol for something really large, you know? So if you're not in a relationship right now or you are in a relationship, this could be the one for you. If you're feeling like,
the next half hour was filled with statements like, you are about to make a major change in your life, and your finances are about to get better, and, oh, you might be dating the one. Next stop, Venice Beach. Sidewalk circus, tourist attraction, no shortage of psychics and fortune tellers.
My name is Luann Hughes. People call me Luna.
She hands me a stack of tarot cards. I shuffle the cards three times, say my name out loud three times, and wait for my divination.
This is good. This is very good.
Luna fans the cards out in front of her and proceeds to rattle off a series of cliches. I am a beacon of light who inspires others. I will do very, very well in my career, a promotion on the horizon, and there will be a party for me in the future. Well, my birthday is in May.
Now, first, you have to put the $50 on the table.
Charles Galperin, a.k.a. Baba Funke, is a Santeria priest. He channels a 500-year-old Congolese spirit named Manuel. I put on my best poker face. I didn't want to give him any clues.
You are a volcano, a subdued volcano at the times, but who can erupt without knowledge and without preparation. Or if you don't explode, you implode and create pain and sorrow to your own self.
This was less fortune-telling than it was therapy.
Get yourself a gong. Hit the gong. Let your soul rise with the gong vibration.
I left his place feeling defensive and confused. I'd always seen fortune-telling as a harmless way to get a glimpse into my future. But maybe when someone seeks insight from a psychic, it's more about insecurity than a need to actually know. Maybe my infatuation with fortune-tellers is really just my need to be reassured that everything's going to be okay. I think I know how 2008 will be for me. It'll be a lot like 2007, except maybe this year I'll stop planning and wondering about my future and just be. Still, in the meantime, what can it hurt? In Los Angeles, I'm Shirley Shin for Week in America.
And you can see pictures of Shirley's adventure when you stop by our website. In fact, I'm reading your mind right now, and you are definitely going to visit us at weekendamerica.org.
Each year, America celebrates its presidents, but we wanted to give some props to their governing sidekicks, the vice presidents. After living in the shadows of the Oval Office, I'll bet plenty of vice presidents believe that their best days began once they got out of office. Al Gore has won a Nobel Prize, a Grammy. He started a whole movement since he's left office. But other vice presidents didn't fare so well, like James Monroe's vice president, Daniel Tompkins. Here's Weekend America's Nate DeMeo.
Things started off great for Daniel D. Tompkins. He was born at a farm in Scarsdale, New York, at the height of the American Revolution, and ran for governor as a farm boy made good. And he was a patriot. So much so that when the New York State Legislature refused to pony up its share of war funding for the War of 1812, Tompkins turned out his own pockets. He borrowed money, and he put up his own house as collateral and paid for the whole state's contribution himself. That's the kind of thing that gets a man elected vice president. But no one pays him back. So he spends his whole time in office suing the government and trying to get out of terrible debt. And drinking. Spends a lot of time drinking. At the end of his second term, he finally gets reimbursed. He heads home to New York with vice president on his resume and money back in his pocket. And 99 days later, he dies.
Wow, that Tompkins was quite a guy. You can read all of Nate's vice presidential vignettes and see a few pictures of them, too. Just stop by our website at weekendamerica.org.
Well, that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. It's been great to have you with us. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. For obscure Black history facts, along with a free podcast of our entire show, go to our website, weekendamerica.org. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
News and financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
What's the best movie line ever? Is it,
"Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn."
Or,
"All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up."
Or,
"Show me the money."
On the next Weekend America, we celebrate the Oscars with some of the best dialogue ever, as decided by you, our listeners. Did you laugh, cry, or did it just make you want to say it every day for the rest of your life?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Join us for the next Weekend America.